This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And good morning, and this is The Deep Dive, and I am your host, Brooke Spector, as usual. It's Friday morning on Chai FM, and today, last week we talked about topics which I think were probably more usual in our area the last couple of weeks. Today, we're going to verge rather dramatically in the direction of military strategy, partly because there are some important and crucial conflicts in the world these days, and partly because David Katz has made himself available to us to do this conversation. David Katz, probably no stranger to many of you, military historian, started out as a chartered accountant and then veered off into military strategy and the military. That's an unusual career progression. Sometimes it goes the other way, I guess, but from chartered accountancy into military strategy is an unusual career path. And I'm going to ask David to explain that to me, how he got there and why it was so fascinating for him. He's written a number of books on military strategy and military history, one of which I have read, 20 Battles. And I want to pose a couple of questions to him and then we'll get started. Given the nature of today's world, we have military conflicts raging in the Ukraine. We have a military conflict which is partially on hold in the Persian Gulf. And we have a military conflict which is semi on hold in northern Israel and southern Lebanon, and on hold in a manner of speaking in Gaza. There is also the question of what I'm going to call the revolution in military technology and military strategy. We hear an awful lot about drones, and we hear an awful lot about autonomous fighting equipment and vehicles. And then I want to ask him a military history question that I've been plagued about by my wife, who is very interested in this topic for family reasons. The old South African Army's Cape Corps. We need some guidance on what it was and why it was important and what happened to it. So, David, welcome, and I'm really pleased to have you. Before we start, unfortunately or fortunately, we have to be nice to our sponsors and ICASA, and I have to read an important message. Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic for Adults offers convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks. Whether you are having regular wellness checks such as blood pressure or cholesterol reading, Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics offer you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care. Find your nearest Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic inside Dis-Chem Pharmacies. Better health starts here. Now we're back to the topic of today. David, welcome for real. And please, tell me why you shifted over from accountancy to military history, and then let's launch into those other questions I've raised.
Brooks, thank you for such a warm welcome. And yes, it's a question I've been asked on a few occasions. And I must say that from a very, very early age, I've had a fascination with military affairs from a young age when I found some partworks on the Second World War in my father's study. And then I used to go and lie, I remember, on the Persian carpet in his study, in absolute fascination. And look at this part work that was printed during the Second World War, and loving the pictures and the stories and that type of thing. So that's where it built on. And even in my varsity years, where I was forced, you know, coming from a Jewish heritage, I was forced to do something practical. I mean, there was no chance whatsoever of me doing anything military at that stage. I was given an ultimatum to say, you'll either be a lawyer, an accountant or a doctor. So I chose to be an accountant because my brother-in-law was one. But even at Wits, when I studied, I used to sneak off to the library and spend hours and hours in their wonderful military section reading all the history books. And I used to go to the banned book section also. And I just had a fascination that never left me. And fortunately, I couldn't wait to get to the army, by the way. I was 28 years old when I was eventually drafted. I'd done all my university. So I was a very old guy when I went to the army, and I was a qualified chartered accountant. And I was quite old when I did it, but I enjoyed it immensely. So it just built more links with the army. And about 15 years ago, there was an opportunity for me to study at Saldanha Military Academy for my master's in military science. I had to do a bridging course because as a chartered accountant, I had no idea of historical methodology or anything like that. And I did my master's, and then the doctorate program fortunately came in. Everything worked for me, and I did my doctorate. And the two sit side by side. I suppose, you know, everything in life are good and great disciplines. So the chartered accountancy together with the doctorate in military science sits side by side quite healthily. So I'm very happy with it.
Well, I mean, my own military career was even less illustrious. This was during the Vietnam War in the U.S., and the draft board gave me 4 days' notice to either be drafted, find a really good excuse why they couldn't draft me, or join a reserve unit. And I spent the next 4 days desperately trying to find a reserve unit. The only thing I could find was an infantry unit, of all things. and they said, "Can you cook?" And I said, "Yes, of course I can cook. I work in a restaurant, among other things." They said, "Fine, you're the new company cook. Go off and be trained." And so that is what happened to me. But let's pose my questions to you again. The conflicts that are in fact in existence now, Ukraine, Russia, the Persian Gulf, Northern Israel, Lebanon and Gaza, ranging from really active hostilities to quasi-ceasefires, and what I call the revolution in military technology, which may well have caught the Pentagon and the U.S. Defense Department slightly off guard. And then finally, as time permits, maybe you can give me an observation or two on the old Cake Corps.
No, that sounds fantastic. Where are we going to start?
Start with Ukraine. Start with Ukraine, because that's the one that's the most vicious fighting now. Strategically, who has the upper hand? Who is deciding the pace of the battle?
Well, Brooks, I'd like to just start off with saying, and I always say this, is that we need to examine warfare at three different levels, and then we can see at what level who's got the advantage where. So if we have a look at warfare, it's usually conducted at three levels, to simplify it, at the tactical level, at the operational level, and at the strategic level. And at the tactical levels where the real fighting takes place, that's the eyeball to eyeball stuff where people get shot and whatever. The operational level is where everything's brought into play so that the tactical warfare can take place. And then of course, there's the big strategic level where all the grand master plans are made. So if we have a look at Ukraine, let's take the Russians, for instance. So let's have a look where they are at the tactical, operational, and the strategic levels. So I would say tactically, they've proved to be reasonably inept. I mean, we expected in the first days of the war some years ago that they would quickly, due to their superiority, technological superiority, so superiority in numbers, superiority in every field, industry, whatever, be able to subdue the Ukrainians within days, and that didn't come off. And they proved to be reasonably tactically inept and operationally inept, because at the operational level, their planning was devoid of any type of inspiration whatsoever. They attacked on narrow fronts using rows. There were massive traffic jams, and the Ukrainians knew the land, the lie of the land, and they were able to stop to stop the invasion quite effectively. So it seemed to be a failure at the operational and the tactical level. Strategically, you can never underestimate the Russians at the strategic level. I wouldn't say this is an outright loss for them, whatever. I mean, they play the long game. These are folk that know how to play the long game and are pretty patient. So at the moment, it's difficult to say strategically who holds the advantage. I mean, it looks as if Ukraine is on the back foot. Certainly with Trump, you don't know whether Trump is supportive of Ukraine or not, and his relationship with Putin. And at times, it's looked very precarious for the Ukrainians. And the Russians are in there for the long term. They can afford the losses. It doesn't seem to be affecting Putin's popularity at home. These massive, massive manpower losses at the front. So, yeah, it's a messy, messy affair. And the messier it gets, I think it gives the Russians advantage, because they are able to, as we've seen in the Second World War, they are able to sustain the losses. They are able to play the long game. They are patient. And it's difficult to say at this stage. I think it's a massive stalemate. And so there may be the stalemate works for the Russians. All the predictions, and I'm sorry if I'm prattling on about this, but all the predictions of the Russian economy collapsing and Putin being thrown out have all come to naught. So it's a difficult one to call.
You've said that, and the things that I have read, and now I grant you, I'm not a military strategist, and nor am I a military technology expert, but from my careful reading of the topic, it seems to me that the Ukrainians have managed the balance between manpower and new technologies more effectively than the Russians have managed to do. Let you think about that for a second. I'm going to do another interaction with our commercial sponsors, and then we will be back, and then you can comment on that question. Let's see here. Thursdays and Fridays mean fresh magic at the Family Bakehouse. Golden Challah's, babkas, biscuits, and cakes baked in small batches with no shortcuts. Perfect for Shabbat or the weekend. Find the Family Bakehouse at Genesis, Orox, and selected distribution centers. And this, of course, is the Deep Dive on High FM. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, David Katz, the man who started out as a chartered accountant because his father laid down an ultimatum and became a military strategist after the chartered accountancy world. We'll be right back after these other messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back. This is the Deep Dive, as you've heard. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Dr. David Katz, from CA to military strategist to author on books of military strategy and history. And just before the break, I posed the question on the Ukraine-Russia conflict that, quite clearly, the Ukrainians have less manpower than the Russians do. The Russians, as David has said, seem to be surprisingly inept in their tactical, let alone their strategic vision. But the Ukrainians may, and I underline the word may, and it's in bold red, all caps type, they may have been able to outmaneuver the Russians with new technology, inexpensive technology, that makes it difficult for the Russians to carry out their strategic objectives. I'm reminded of the old saying from a boxer who said, everybody has a strategy till they get punched in the mouth.
I think that was Mike Tyson that said that.
And it was indeed.
And it's quite true, absolutely true. So, okay, we're talking about a few different things here. Well, let's have a look at the effect of drone warfare and the advent of cheap drones, inexpensive, let's put it that way, inexpensive, relatively inexpensive drones on the battlefield and the effect that they've had. So you've spoken about a revolution in military affairs. I'm very careful of that term, revolution in military affairs. In fact, when I think back on the evolution of warfare and all the different items that have been introduced to warfare, like gunpowder and the tank and aircraft and that type of thing. And I try and equate it with the term revolution in military affairs. I would rather use evolution in military affairs, because the most effective armies in the world have inducted the new technology into their existing doctrine. In other words, they've used it in combined arms warfare. In other words, they will take in the new technology and put it in as a extra tool in the toolbox, rather than this new tool changing the nature of warfare. So now what we've seen in Ukraine, which is quite interesting, this started off as a war of maneuver. There was great maneuver on it. And the Russians attempted to outmaneuver the Ukrainians on narrow fronts. They attacked everywhere simultaneously, probing to see if there were weaknesses in the Ukrainian front. It's sort of the Soviet deep strategy that they have, where they attack on a wide front, probing to see where the weaknesses are. Then once they found the weaknesses, they reinforce strength in those areas, and they break through the lines. And it started off like that. And unfortunately for them is that they stuck to the very narrow roadways and highways and were able to be stopped. And that came to naught. And it soon descended into a static World War I type of warfare, which is quite a failure, because that's the end of maneuver. And the two sides began to entrench. Now, you also got to understand that once you go onto the defensive, you have certain force multipliers, you have certain advantages. The defense has an advantage over the attacker. The attacker is always going to have to outnumber in strong defensive positions. If you man strong defensive positions, the attacker is always going to have to produce more firepower to overcome you. I want to move away from the numerical side of things, but certainly we're looking at a firepower of 3-1 or more. More favorable than that, sometimes 5-1 in order to overcome the defenders. So this suited the Ukrainians immensely, to be able to sit on static lines, defending well entrenched positions, using their numerical disadvantage, using their defensive positions to increase the firepower as a force multiplier, using those defensive positions in order to overcome the Russians' numerical superiority. And then we add in this whole aspect of drones, which I don't think is quite, well, it has sort of changed the nature of what's happening in the Ukraine at the moment, but it shouldn't have. It shouldn't have. It's like when the tank was first introduced into combat during World War I, and then the Germans perfected the art of the tank. Now, the way the Germans perfected the art of the tank was not to use it as an independent weapon, but to integrate it within a combined arms together with the infantry and artillery, and use them all in unison and therefore overcome the enemy. So what we are looking at now is the two sides now are grappling with how to deal with these drones and these unmanned vehicles. And I have no doubt it's always a battle. You know, you saw the Israelis also being taken by surprise in 1973 by handheld anti-tank weapons, and it seemed the day of the tank was over. And really it wasn't until the balance was brought back into it. And I think we're going to see the balance brought back into warfare again once there are weapon systems designed to take down these drones. It's no good taking down a drone with a multi-million rand weapon when the drone itself only costs a couple of thousand dollars. But something obviously technologically wise will be on the way to once again redress the balance. So that is sort of my understanding of what's happening in the Ukraine. It's a stalemate situation. Both sides are sitting in static positions, very, very vulnerable. They aren't able to use their maneuver weapons because these maneuver weapons are very, very vulnerable to these inexpensive drones flying around. And that's where we are at the moment.
And now you've mentioned the Middle East in passing. Let's shift our gaze toward the interrelated but separate sets of conflicts that are the one, the Persian Gulf, which now seems to be in a hostile but not necessarily active military action. Then there is the Northern Israel, Lebanon, Hezbollah conflict, which theoretically is some sort of a ceasefire in place. And the Gaza circumstances in which there is, well, there's a kind of ceasefire, in part because there's not so much left to have to fight over, to put it bluntly. But start with the Persian Gulf and two conflicting blockades. The Iranians arguing that they have a set of demands which include change, a serious change in the nature of innocent passage and the Americans obviously insisting that the Ukrainian, that the Iranian defense no longer be permitted to continue in any direction toward nuclear weapons development. It's a stalemate, but it's not an end, and there are conflict elements in there. Where do we go from here? What's going to happen next is the question people wish to know.
Yeah, that is the million-dollar question. I've asked this on my show on numerous occasions of various people, and depending on who you speak to, you're going to get different answers. And I've spoken to very intelligent people and people who understand, and they still come up with different answers. So these are murky waters that we are wading through at the moment when it comes to it. And there's so much misinformation out there also blurring the whole understanding of what is happening there. So let me give you my best shot after having spoken to numerous people about this matter. So I have no doubt in my mind that the Iranian conventional forces have been soundly beaten. Their navy lies at the bottom of the sea. Their navy is non-existent. Their leadership has been decimated. I believe their command and control has been irreparably destroyed. And they are unable to issue coherent orders. I believe they speak with many voices. I think the center of power in Iran also resides in different places, and we don't know exactly who the spokesman is for them. So this is where the Iranians sit at the moment. So they conventionally have been quite comprehensively defeated. The Americans and the Israelis enjoy air superiority. They can do whatever they want there. And now we have a situation where the Iranians have blockaded the Straits of Hormuz, which obviously poses massive economic implications for the rest of the world, not so much the Americans who are sitting on their own oil stockpile, but certainly for the world economy, which does affect the Americans. But certainly this is not good for the Chinese and the others that are dependent on Iranian oil, the Indians. So the Iranians, to a certain extent, are holding the world economies hostage over this. The Americans have done a counter blockade. So that there's two clocks ticking here. There's the clock, there's the world clock ticking, the world economic clock ticking, putting pressure on the Americans to arrive at some type of a settlement. And then you have the Iranian clock ticking, which is that if they carry on this way and the American blockade persists, they are now going to start damaging their economy irreparably. And with 70% of their population below the age of 30, you can imagine the political tensions within Iran building up. So I would say to you this, we're sitting in a situation now. Which clock is going to expire first? Is Trump going to have to submit to the pressures that he's receiving from all over the world to end this conflict? Or are the Iranians going to cave in first because the economy is on a fast track to being trashed and they're not going to recover from it?
Part of the... I want to go back to your tripart analysis, the tactical, the operational, and the strategic. The Americans and the Israelis, I guess, as partners in this, succeeded at the tactical and operational level. but the Trump administration demonstrated its lack of understanding of the broader strategic purposes of the conflict, the broader strategic ideas. I mean, it seemed to me, if you look at a map, any map almost of the Middle East, you look at the Strait of Hormuz, it's 21 miles or 30 kilometers across. That was the single most salient geographical feature of the region. And since it is a chokehold on pushing a quarter of the globe's energy requirements, it seemed incomprehensible that the American establishment was not attuned to the idea that that was the real danger point, rather than the missiles or the presumed nuclear development sites, or even the government command and control. But I wasn't in charge.
No, I hear you, but we're making a couple of assumptions. First of all, the first assumption we're making is that they didn't consider what would happen with the Straits of Hormuz. That's the first assumption. I'm not 100% sure that wasn't thought about in the various scenarios that they had looked at. The second assumption that we're making is that the strategic game is over for the Americans, and it certainly isn't. We're 75 days into this war, and as I said, the clocks are ticking. I don't know whose clock is going to expire first and who can afford to do what, but the strategic situation is far from over. Far from over. I think we're at the beginning of looking at this at the strategic side. And then I say to you also is that there are two different of strategic objectives between the Israelis and the Americans. Some of it is congruent, but others is not. And that the Israelis are certainly in a far better strategic position than they were before this war started. Or if we look back a couple of years back to October the 7th, they were in a very, very precarious position. And now that ring of fire has been dismantled. The Iranians have been, to a certain extent, the missile capability has been defanged. Hezbollah is certainly a shadow of what was formerly. They've managed to seize areas in the Golan, which puts them in a great tactical position there. Gaza, to a certain extent, has been contained. I mean, nothing is 100% conclusive of the Israeli side. But I don't think they're walking away from the saying to them, you know, this is a strategic failure. The Israeli is certainly, it's more clear cut. But I would say we have to be more patient on the side of the Americans, depending on that clock, because people are not patient with it. And I just don't think the jury's out on this yet.
Well, David, I would add one footnote to what you said. I'm not sure I'm going to disagree on the dueling clocks metaphor, because I think it's a good one. But that there's a third clock ticking as well. And that's the American domestic political circumstances, with it including the added word affordability and economic growth, or the lack of it, and the rise in prices, and the midterm election in the United States just a few months into the future. That's the third clock that also is running, and that will not determine the precise nature of the battlefield, but it is going to determine the way in which the Trump administration thinks about the battlefield.
Absolutely.
But let's shift quickly, if we can, to a little bit of consideration of the other side of the Middle East. You've argued that the Israelis are in a better strategic position now than they were certainly 2 years ago, with their positions in southern Lebanon, the way in which Gaza has been dealt with, but also, unfortunately, perhaps the way in which they are dealing with the West Bank, which I would argue is possibly more of an Achilles heel for the Israelis than people are willing to immediately assume.
No, I think there's concerns there. There are huge political issues. We need to remember also that the Israelis are pretty much a divided society. That certainly has been subsumed with the current situation that they find in themselves. But there is political divisiveness there within the Israeli community also, which is not going to help the situation once these matters are settled. The West Bank is a problem, and there has to be a political settlement there somehow. And it seems to me that the two-state solution now has been irreparably put onto the back foot for a long time because of this war, because of the nature of the Israeli government at this stage, is that the right wing is in the ascendancy. So there are problems there. From the Abraham Accord side, I believe that the Israelis are maybe in a stronger position. I think there are more Arab nations, more neighbors around there that are willing to sit down and settle with Israel on some type of a basis going forward. So yeah, it's there are mixed messages coming out of this whole thing. I hope that illuminates a bit from my point of view.
Yeah, I mean, in a very non-official tacit sense, the Persian Gulf nations and even Saudi Arabia have seen at least the potential track forward in dealing with Israel that might not have been there just a few years ago. We're going to have to break for another ad. Important messages. If we don't, the station gets really angry with me for not doing these things, and our sponsors get really angry with the station, and then, oh my goodness, fire and brimstone rains down upon me.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooks Spector.
And this is indeed, just as the introduction said, this is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooks Spector, IFM, of course. And my guest, Dr. David Katz. I emphasize the doctor in this case, not because he's going to treat your bruises and wounds and you know, deal with your kidneys, but his doctorate is in military strategy and military history, which I find fascinating. Dad told him to be a chartered accountant, a doctor, or a lawyer, and he ended up as a military historian. And that's just that's wonderfully interesting he was drawn that way over time. And I'm looking at I assume that's his study, and there are posters of various books that he has authored or co-authored, including one that I had actually read, The 20 Battles. Then you have a book up there with South Africans against Rommel, and then a book on Jan Smuts, and various other books. It's an interesting collection of historical interactions. But I would be remiss if I didn't respond to my wife's near constant concern, interest in the unit in World War II that her father and I guess several uncles and thousands of other people participated in, the Cape Corps. And I have looked in vain for any sort of real history of that unit. And it was in North Africa from Cairo to, I believe, as far as Tobruk, but I have yet to find anything on it, except for occasional scattered references in larger histories. David, can you possibly illuminate this for me?
The first thing I'm going to do for you is point you to two publications that will help you with that. And as you say, the information on the Cape Corps is sparse, and it shouldn't be. There's a young gent called Karl Harmse who wrote his master's thesis on the Cape Colored Corps, and it did a wonderful job. I think he might have restricted it to their military service in the First World War. I don't know if he covered anything in the Second World War. I'm not 100% sure, but his thesis is available online. So it's Karl Harmse. Mm-hmm. And if you search for it, if you search his name online, if you've got a problem, you can always contact me, and I can put you in touch with that. It's well worth having a look at. The other one is a regimental history by a Colonel Difford, and Colonel Difford was that's Difford, and it's a regimental history. I think it's called the Cape Colored Corps. I'm not 100% sure about that. It's a book that's long out of print, but you can get it on some of these secondhand book websites. Mm-hmm. He was officer in command of the Cape Colored Corps, and he wrote this very, very good regimental history. As far as I'm aware, there may be other publications, but as far as I'm aware, those are the two main publications. Obviously, with Karl Harmse doing a hell of a lot of good work on it about bringing it to the fore. So yes, it is. The colors in this country have an illustrious military history, stretching right back to the early days of 1652, when Jan van Riebeck landed at the coast. One of the battles that they partook in, that people know little about, is the Battle of Muizenberg against the British, and the Dutch fielded quite a large contingent of coloured soldiers in their army. So, I mean, through the various centuries, the coloureds have fought for various organisations, fought on various sides, and certainly fought for the Union Defence Force in the First World War, Union Defence Force in the Second World War, and have a proud military history with the South African Defence Force and the border wars.
That's helpful. I mean, I raise it because in recent years, certainly, the circumstances of soldiers in the African Labor Corps, I guess it was called then, who died on the SS Mendi, and there have been books and a musical and a play written about it, and I gather somebody is doing a film on it eventually. But by the same token, the Cape Corps and the men who fought or served in it have gotten much less public attention, almost as if it's an afterthought or, for some people at least, vaguely embarrassing to have been on the side of the government, notwithstanding the fact that this was during the First and Second World Wars, among other things, which were existential moments in a lot of ways. I guess what I'm aiming at is the idea that that military circumstances in South Africa have a broader texture and a broader range of content than simply the much older style of writing, which talks about regiments fighting Rommel, regiments serving in the trenches in World War I in France, and working their way up through Northeast Africa into what was then Abyssinia. And the assumption always being, in the way these are written and described, that these are exclusively white troops doing things on behalf of empire and government rather than the bigger texture.
No, absolutely. There's complete misconception as to the black, coloured and Asian roles in the let's just use the Union Defence Force for example. First World War and Second World War, they made a massive contribution to the fighting power of the Union Defence Force in various roles, either in fighting roles. Certainly, the Cape Coloured Corps had a fighting role in Egypt during the First World War. The blacks in this country had support roles, but often found themselves actually fighting with captured weapons against the enemy. They had a massive role in the Union Defence Force, certainly in the support services, and they have a proud history. And the reason why we don't know about it is because of the nationalist government that wrote this out of our history when they took power in 1948. And they didn't subscribe to any history that involved us fighting on the side of the Allied forces or the United Kingdom. They were interested in a republic, and they were interested in distancing our history and everything that we from the empire and from away from the United Kingdom. So this was a history that was suppressed from 1948 to 1994. Along with the advent of the democratic government that came in 1994, you would have thought that things would have loosened up and we would have paid attention to this type of history. And once again, it's not a usable history to the current government. So for the last 30 years, it's been suppressed or ignored, and we have a national amnesia about it. And the youth of the day just don't know, not interested, etc., in the history of their forefathers. Because it's been under severe attack for 85 years or more under the various governments. So it's our job as historians now to bring this up to the fore. And I must say there's a pretty good bunch of historians here in South Africa that are addressing these issues. One of them being Bill Nassen, who was a professor at Stellenbosch University, and he wrote a lot of books on that include the colored contribution and the black contribution into the war. So there is, you can search for it. It is out there. More needs to be done. And certainly it needs to become part of the school syllabus. It's a long struggle.
David, I have to break again, if I might, for another commercial message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back to the final moments. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, as you heard on High FM. We're speaking today with Dr. David Katz, probably well known to many of you who listen to these programs. He does a lot of radio himself. And what we're talking about, military history, military strategy, and in a way, a look forward into the near future. We have just a minute or two left, and I'm going to ask David if he couldn't just wrap up the military prognosis, Ukraine, Russia, Persian Gulf, the Western Mediterranean, that's Lebanon, Israel, Gaza. Is there a larger strategic picture, idea we can draw from all of these military conflicts? Is there one thing that we should know, we should take away after we look at each of them and see them together?
I think what we've discovered, Brooks, astoundingly, is that how interconnected these various conflicts are and how dependent the resolution of each one of them is on the other. And certainly we can't isolate these conflicts and say that whatever happens in the Ukraine is not going to affect what happens in the Middle East. I think we're almost going to be looking at a package deal here, a final resolution of all these conflicts, because they are so interlinked, and the world today geopolitically is so interlinked, so dependent. Each region is so dependent on the other, and so dependent on the raw materials. So you can already see that. It's also flattened the three levels of war, this type of thing, the tactical, operational, strategical. You can see some of the tactical results have strategic implications. I mean, with an Israeli soldier chopping up a statue of Jesus Christ, which is really, it's not a strategic situation there. That's just something that's been done at the tactical level by an ordinary soldier walking around has massive strategic effects that reverberate throughout the world and can change actually the strategic outlook in a lot of ways. So, we're looking at that type of thing. So, look, Trump is now in China. I don't know whether he's going to come out with some type of a deal. I think he's been holding out for that. That's very interlinked. Chinese have a lot of influence on what happens in Ukraine and have a lot of influence on the Russians. They've got a lot of influence on the Iranians. If Trump can win over the Chinese to come to some type of an arrangement, we could see a settlement in the Ukraine. We could see a settlement in Iran because of Chinese pressure. All these things sort of hang on a knife edge, interrelated, very, very complicated. And as I've said to you before, difficult to discern what's going on because of so much misinformation coming out from everywhere. We need to just sort of stand back and coolly try and see what's happening out there. So I can't give you any definite answers. All I can say is it's the messy middle. And we need to see the interrelatedness of everything, and we're just going to have to be patient and see how this turns out.
And here I was hoping that David Katz would look into his crystal ball, stare at his Ouija board, peer at those tea leaves, and say, it's going to be this way. And
no, unfortunately not. Unfortunately not.
Well, you just gave the same answer I did. Everything is interrelated, and it is impossible at this moment to tell, which means we'll have to have another conversation about this some point in the future. This has been Brooke Spector with Deep Dive on High FM, and my guest today, it's been a pleasure. David Katz, from chartered accountant to military historian, and not Nostradamus on the Middle East or the Persian Gulf or the Ukraine, but helping us get a little bit more insight into how these things are progressing and why they're going the way they are. David, thanks very much for joining us.